Good afternoon from USC's Annenberg Media Center, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For Thursday, October 26, 2017, I'm Nadia Caldwell. First, a news update with Tommy Durkin.
A USC graduate student is taking one of her professors to court over sexual harassment. As Sebastian Vega reports, the student and her attorney held a news conference this morning.
USC graduate student Carissa Fenwick told reporters she was sexually harassed by Dr. Eric Guerrero in January during a professional conference in New Orleans. Guerrero was her dissertation supervisor and in charge of the doctoral dissertation committee.
Including sitting me on his bed and leaning over trying to kiss me, only stopping once I started yelling in protest and ran past him out of the room. At the same conference, he cornered me in a conversation and told me that if I ever told anybody about what happened, that it would ruin both of our careers.
Fenwick filed a lawsuit against Guerrero earlier this week. In an email to Annenberg Media, Guerrero said it was sad to see that some people take advantage of a serious issue to continue their lives of white privilege. Fenwick acknowledged today that she does have white privilege, but she says he had gender privilege.
At the same time, in this situation, because he's like an employed, tenured faculty member directly supervising me, I think that he had much more power in the situation than I did, despite any white privilege that I might have.
Guerrero says that the allegations are false and that he expects the court process will be rigorous and fair. The university issued a statement saying that Guerrero is being disciplined and he will be removed from supervising students. Fenwick's lawsuit also alleges that Guerrero harassed another student, and it charges that the university did not take strong enough action against the professor. For Annenberg Media, I'm Sebastian Vega.
Lydia Lee contributed to that report. Today, Thursday, October 26th, is the release date for about 3,000 government files on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. The details have been classified for exactly 25 years since the enactment of the President John F. Kennedy Records Collection Act, put in place in 1992. Richard Reeves, a political journalist, USC professor, and author of President Kennedy, A Profile of Power, spoke with Ava Macha on the reasoning behind the classification of the files all those years ago.
Well, I was there. It was because of the Oliver Stone movie, JFK, and I certainly haven't changed my mind that the movie was a total fraud and that the people he accused, including Lyndon Johnson, had nothing to do with what happened that terrible November day.
The professor also made some speculations into the potential content of the declassified files and what he thought would be the most shocking reveal.
Yeah, obviously I don't know, but the most shocking thing would be an acknowledgement that John F. Kennedy was behind the attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro and other world leaders during his presidency.
The 2,800 documents were set to be released at midnight. However, due to concerns of national security, President Trump has redacted multiple pieces of information, keeping many conspiracy theories alive. President Donald Trump declared the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency today. In a speech at the White House, the president said the crisis is ripping the nation apart. The president also instructed federal agencies to do everything in their power to combat the crisis. USC professor Rick Bluthenthal, who specializes in preventative medicine, says it is just not enough.
The change or the declaration doesn't really free up additional money. You know, there's no money associated with it, so that's not particularly helpful. Some of the loosening of the regulations is helpful, and the additional utilization of existing funds that can be put to this purpose, you know, is helpful, but we need to do a lot more.
Some additional steps the president is calling for include a marketing campaign and providing relief for state governments to access Medicaid funding for drug treatment centers with more than 16 beds. After almost a week of excessive heat and unseasonably high temperatures, Los Angeles begins to cool off as we enter the weekend. Tonight we're going to have clear skies with a low of 64, and tomorrow we'll have a high of 87. Temperatures will continue falling through the weekend, with Monday's high projected to be 71 degrees. So take advantage of the warm weather while we have it, Los Angeles, because fall is finally here. Today is the last day for all U.S. airports to comply with new security screening for carry-on luggage. Charlotte Scott reports.
It was business as usual today at LAX, but for travelers with carry-on luggage, there will be extra screening precautions. All electronic devices, larger than a cell phone, will need to be put in a separate bin during security screening. The TSA enacted this new precaution out of fear that explosives could be planted in tablets or other electronic devices. However, not many passengers we spoke with were affected by the new TSA rule.
No, we just got like the customs declaration thing at the end. Well, we were stopped because I had like a bag of coins, which has never happened before.
It was kind of smooth. I was expecting more difficult.
Just ask me why you come here, like how many days you stay here, something like that.
TSA spokeswoman Lori Dankers said in an email to Annenberg Media that the United States and the global aviation community face an adaptive and agile enemy. She says there are continued terrorist threats to airliners and that the extra security will keep the traveling public safe. For Annenberg Media, I'm Charlotte Scott.
Tian Lu Wu contributed to that report. It's 6 minutes after the hour. I'm Tommy Durkin.
Thanks, Tommy. Coming up on From Where We Are, did you know that USC is home to historical buildings, including ones built in the 70s? Event security fees for conservative speakers visiting on college campuses are increasing with the recent political climate. Who should be paying these fees? Karina Sadie has the story.
The UCLA Bruin Republicans are protesting potential security fees for an upcoming speech by conservative Ben Shapiro. School officials stated that if over 30% of people in attendance would be from outside the UCLA community, then the group would be charged. The Republican group cites these costs as a violation of the First Amendment right. Jordan Sadler, the president of the organization, was shocked at how much they may have to pay.
However, what they could tell me about the amount was that there would be no way that I would be able to pay, that I could be able to pay on my own.
A legal organization representing the group addressed Chancellor Jean Block on Monday. In a letter, the Alliance Defending Freedom referred to these fees as unconstitutional and discriminatory. The activism director, Jacob Ellenhorn, thinks the university is not entirely supporting free speech.
What we see here is that UCLA is very happy to allow freedom of speech, but only freedom of speech it agrees with.
Shapiro's event is expected to address the rise of campus fascism. He plans to discuss the increasing intolerance towards freedom of speech on campuses. In the past year, similar events at colleges by conservative speakers have sparked protests. Senior council member Tyson Langhofer shared his perspective in an online recording by the Alliance.
As the U.S. Supreme Court has made very clear, public universities can't enact policies that effectively stifle free speech just because administrators fear protesters might show up. The reason for that is simple. Speech isn't free if all it takes to silence it is for someone else to object.
But when we spoke with Ciaran McAvoy, USC law professor, he didn't think the university would treat any other group differently.
The university already is saying that, you know, this is a content-neutral thing. So instead of targeting the speech, this sort of applies to every group.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Karina Sadie.
In today's episode of The International Current, Ryan Thompson reviews the situation in Niger.
American troops are on the ground in Niger, and for most Americans, this is a complete surprise. Welcome to The International Current. Today, America's shadow war in Africa. What happened in Niger, and how is it a microcosm for other U.S. military efforts across the continent? I'm Ryan Thompson. 4 American troops died during a surprise ambush in Niger earlier in October, and it's just becoming news now.
Tonight, there are new questions about the final hours of 4 American soldiers. A report in the New York Times today says the Pentagon's timeline, where the soldiers were ambushed after a planned visit to a village elder, might not be the entire story.
If you haven't followed the story, let me catch you up. October 4th, a U.S. patrol in rural Niger took fire. The team requested support, but help didn't arrive for at least an hour. During the firefight, three U.S. soldiers were killed, and a fourth, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, turned up dead 2 days later. In the weeks since, there's been a lot of backlash in Washington, and lawmakers have been asking a ton of questions to make sense of the tragic event. But outside of Washington, many Americans were surprised by the news that four American troops were ambushed in Niger. And many Americans couldn't help but say, wait, what? Where is Niger, and since when have we had troops on the ground there? It turns out the U.S. has some pretty extensive military operations in Africa. More than 6,000 troops are on the ground across the continent. But what exactly are we doing there? Joining me to explain is one of the first journalists to cover the ambush, a former U.S. Navy SEAL who served special operations a number of times, being deployed to Central and West Africa, Kaj Larson. Thank you so much for being here, Kaj.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. It's an honor to be here.
So why were U.S. forces in Niger in the first place?
We have strategic interests in Africa. Now, some people will say that we don't, but it's generally accepted that we have strategic interests in Africa. And those interests there, they're economic, they're political, they're military, and they're diplomatic. One of the best ways to engage in Africa from a U.S. perspective is through these military engagements, military to military engagements. So we have troops that go, we have U.S. soldiers and U.S. forces that go to all these different countries in Africa. Now, the troops that we have in Niger are very specifically dedicated to a counterterrorism mission. Niger sits at a particularly dangerous neighborhood at a nexus between a bunch of transnational migration routes and patterns, some of which involved some pretty nefarious actors, terrorist groups, right? So Niger sits at this strategic hub where a lot of terrorist groups or terrorist-associated movements or fundamentalist-associated movements are operating.
And to your point, there's Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in Mali and southern Algeria. But what are we doing on the ground there if we're not at war with these groups?
Essentially training African militaries, training our African counterparts to be better at what they do. So that's everything from basic tactics to shooting, to even to communications, to teaching their leadership how to work through a military decision-making process or a mission planning operation. And the idea is that in doing that, you will be able to counter these terrorist movements that are transiting across this, frankly, area that has lots of ungoverned space where there's not a lot of government reach into. You'll be able to counter those kind of movements, and you'll just, in general, promote stability in the region because you have these stronger rule of law and stronger African militaries.
Many have criticized this mission, saying that the intelligence was poor, the risk assessment was badly done. From your experience in special ops in this region, do we have strong enough intelligence to send troops safely, or can things get pretty messy pretty quickly?
What we often say in military planning and special operations planning is that no battle plan survives the first shot. Right? You have all these great plans, but then as soon as there's like a contact or a kinetic action, like it all goes to hell. Nowhere is this more true than Africa. Of course, we have intelligence operations. Of course, we have information. Of course, we have collection capabilities. But Africa is a vastly complicated space, and you're dealing with really poor infrastructure, really poor local governments and populations that you're dealing with, and having a good operational picture of what's happening in these parts of Africa is very difficult. And we wish we had a much more clear picture of how it all worked.
Kaj Larson, thank you so much for your insight on this subject.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Anytime.
Kaj Larson recently published a video op-ed about this subject. You can watch it on Now This. A link to that is on our website, uscannenbergmedia.com. For Annenberg Media, I'm Ryan Thompson.
The USC's men water polo team is number one in the country. For one of their freshman drivers, being a Trojan is a family affair. Our sports reporter sat down with Marko Vavich for this week's Hear from Heritage.
So as a freshman, first year on the team, kind of what's that acclimation process been like to USC water polo?
It's not too been bad for me because I've actually been here the last couple summers. Because SC plays as a club in the summer, so I got to play with the guys, and I've kind of known them for the last couple of years, so it's not been hard for me.
And kind of now that you're actually on the team itself, are there any key skills that you've learned from some of the older guys?
I think it's just getting used to playing with this kind of team. I mean, obviously in high school, I've been the top player, and then coming here and getting used to playing with all the superstars from all the different like schools and areas, that's something that you got to learn to like use them to your advantage as well.
And someone else that you need to use to your advantage is your own dad, who's the coach of the team.
Yeah.
Is he any different now that you're, you know, coaching him in the pool versus kind of out of the pool?
Our relationship in the pool and out of the pool is definitely different. He separates the two of them very well. I've known what it's like to get coached with him. I've been coached with him pretty much my whole life. And there hasn't been anything like that I haven't expected so far.
What do you think is one key lesson that your dad has taught you?
Just to work as hard as you can. That's definitely it.
More so in the pool or out of the pool?
Both. In the pool preparation and out of the pool preparation. It's definitely the key to everything.
Now, I know in the pool you are third in the MPSF in goals with 31 so far this season. It was your first year on the team. That's a pretty high accomplishment. Are there any keys that you're kind of still working on with that?
No. I mean, I'm not too focused on scoring goals as much as just like playing the right way and just winning and trying to get a national championship.
The buildings on USC's campus are not just visually interesting, but also culturally significant. Students walk past some of Los Angeles's historical cultural monuments every day. Here's Helen Arase with the story.
The University of Southern California is home to not one, not two, but 13 historical cultural monuments. That's right, and the newest one of them is the original building of the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, which was built in 1979. Now wait a minute. The 70s may seem long ago, but it's not really historical, and if you've seen Annenberg, it doesn't exactly fit in with the architecture of the rest of the campus. My team and I thought we'd go check it out.
So what do you think about this building?
To me, it kind of looks like big and white and blocky. Like from here, from the bottom of the building, with these white columns, it looks like the bottom of an ice tray, right? You're just waiting for the ice cubes to go in. That's just half the building.
I mean, I guess it's quite interesting coming from Europe that this qualifies as a historical building when obviously it's from 1979.
It was really cutting edge when the building opened and showcases a particular moment in time in architecture.
That's Trudy Sammeyer, director of the USC Historic Preservation Program.
It is a series of cubes offset from one another, set at different levels. It is cast concrete forms with waffle slabs. It looks a little like something you would build with an erector set. It's kind of got these interesting shapes and inserts and cutouts and things like that that make it sort of fascinating.
Annenberg was built by the firm of A. Quincy Jones, a groundbreaking architect who was the dean of USC School of Architecture. Sammeyer told us that the building shows where Jones was in his career and his innovative use of concrete to define volumes of space.
The USC campus is kind of a sea of red brick. And the buildings that aren't are the ones that really stand out. They are the ones that make a statement.
So the next time you're walking through campus, take a second to look at this unique building. It's an architectural window into a moment in time when USC was looking to the future. For Annenberg Media, I'm Helen Arase.
A journalist from Yemen has been denied a visa to the United States. As Alexandria Mason reports, she was coming to Los Angeles to accept an award.
This is Yemeni journalist Adil Al-Yamani reporting in the field as an explosion happens just feet away from her. She's wearing a hijab, covered by a helmet, and a bulletproof vest labeled press. She doesn't even flinch. It's her fearlessness, reporting on the front lines of Yemen's civil war, that won her the 2017 Courage in Journalism Award, given each year by the International Women in Media Foundation. Last night, the foundation held an award ceremony in Hollywood that featured the other two awardees, but Al-Yamani had to give her acceptance by video. Here's a snippet of her video-recorded acceptance speech.
I dedicate this award to my abducted colleagues in two prisons who are subject to abuse and death-causing torture.
In a statement released last week, the foundation said that, despite letters of support and the IWMF's advocacy effort on Al-Yamani's behalf, under a section of the U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act, applicants might not receive a U.S. visa if they don't provide all the needed documents.
She applied for the visa months and months in advance.
Alisa Lees Munoz is the executive director of IWMF. She says Al-Yamani had all the documents that were requested.
There is enough public outrage. Maybe there would have been a review of the application. But I think that's what we would do differently, is just make it a lot more well-known earlier so that there might be a change of heart.
The crowd at the award dinner was crushed when they announced Al-Yamani wouldn't be making a live appearance. USC Annenberg Dean Willow Bay was a co-host at the event.
I think what we heard was an audible gasp from the audience, who was looking forward to acknowledging Hadiel's Courage in Journalism Award and really looking forward to hearing from her in person.
A number of journalism students were in the audience too. Natalie Kiyomonkun was one of them.
I was devastated because she's so young and so influential in the female journalism world that her not being there really spoke so many volumes.
Was it upsetting?
It was very upsetting, I think.
It's suspected that the visa was denied because of President Trump's new travel ban that went into effect last month. It bans travelers to the United States from 8 countries, including Yemen. IWMF says that in the future, they will initiate more of an outcry to stand by the rights of all journalists. For Annenberg Media, I'm Alexandria Mason.
Right now, the Columbus Crew is playing Atlanta FC in the Major League Soccer playoffs, but fans in Columbus are worried they might not have their team for much longer. Crew owner Anthony Precourt is threatening to move the team to Austin, Texas. Chris Perfett sat down with Morgan Hughes, a fan of the Crew and representative of SaveTheCrew.com.
Morgan Hughes, thanks for joining us. For those who might not be aware of what's happening in Columbus with the Columbus Crew, could you give a little background on the events that have been happening just in the past week?
Last Monday, we found out late in the evening that Anthony Precourt was planning to move the Columbus Crew from Columbus to Austin. He said that that was because he wasn't able to build a downtown stadium, and he said the team would be gone if he didn't get it. It was a giant shock to us, and after a day of mourning and grieving the potential loss of our team and our cherished city asset, we decided that we were done being victims and that we needed to stand up and fight this thing and try to keep our team in our city.
So I know that other sports leagues in America, they've threatened in the past to move their teams pending stadium deals. But this is the first time it's really happened with Major League Soccer, a league that proclaims itself to be about the fans, the supporters above all else.
Well, it's, like you said, it's unique because it's an MLS team and Major League Soccer attempting to hold a city ransom for a new stadium when they already have a dedicated soccer-specific stadium in which they are the primary tenant. So we've never seen anything like this. So if I were to say that I saw it coming, I don't think that would be accurate. I'm not sure that anybody saw it coming, especially because Columbus Crew SC is the league's first team, the charter member. And Crew Stadium, now known as Mafre Stadium, is the first soccer-specific stadium. And, you know, we have been the home to the United States national team whenever they have an important game, usually against Mexico, you know, since the stadium opened up. And so I never thought in a million years that they would have the audacity to try to take this thing that means so much to so many away from Columbus.
I'm reading here from the Columbus Dispatch. Major League Soccer registered Austin Athletics and Austin FC earlier this year, and reports are saying now that Precourt's plans to move the team to Austin goes back even further, potentially to when he first bought the team in 2013. Were you aware of any of this before the news broke last week that Austin might be the potential future of this franchise?
So I was aware of the Austin branding earlier in the year. I think that came out in June. But, you know, with the relationship that Major League Soccer has with the USL and the way that they like to proactively trademark things, it didn't cause me any great concern. There was talk that Anthony Precourt was down there during that time, and I thought, well, that can't mean anything because he is on the expansion committee, and so he looks at a lot of markets. I'm sure that, you know, he has to do his due diligence for the league and the committee on which he serves. But I thought that the branding trademark was probably for a USL team. It didn't really strike me as anything that was of great threat. But to speak to your second question, nobody that I know of, including media, was aware of the words written into the contract, the legalese that was in there that would allow Precourt to leave specifically for Austin, Texas. That came as a big shock.
So what has the response been from supporters and fans around the league in regards to the situation in Columbus?
So on Tuesday night, we kind of all decided collectively that we were done being his victim and that we were going to fight back. In times of great trouble, really all you have is that fight or flight mode that kicks in. And I know that a lot of people were down and felt like maybe it's time to roll over and give up, but we decided as a community to stand up, brush our shoulders off, and start fighting this. So we created a movement called Save the Crew. We got a website up and running. I believe that was Wednesday, so it hasn't even been a week. We just started rallying the troops, and by about Thursday, it was clear that the rest of the league and the rest of the country was behind us, you know, because Columbus is a meaningful place for American soccer, which is a sport that you really don't have much legitimate history. So what little history we have as a country, we need to be very protective of it. And I think that's why you saw what you saw on Decision Day from around the league. Now we set up something on our website where you could sign up to help and also sign up to get a free banner. And we got over, as of last count, it was over 1,000 banner requests and over 4,000 registered helpers. So the interesting part of that, you know, is that all of the everything, all of the banners, all of the songs, all of the hard hats, all of the captain's armbands in yellow and displays that you saw around the league this past weekend, none of it was made by us. Our fabric hasn't even come in yet. Those were supporters of every team in the league saying to their ownership, not good enough, not okay. This is unacceptable. This thing is picking up steam. As crazy as it sounds, we had, you know, 2,000 people at City Hall here in Columbus and another 2,000 watching via live stream. So we had over 4,000 people to, you know, watching a rally that we didn't even plan until Thursday. So 3 days notice, we had 4,000 people. It was nuts. And, you know, hopefully we're going to be a team that's in the playoffs so that you will definitely see shows of signs of support for Save the Crew, because we'll be there. We have a game against Atlanta at Atlanta on Thursday. It's a knockout round game. And, you know, that's a tough place to play, but we're hopeful that we're going to get out of there with a W. And like I said, only time will tell. But if what we've seen just in the last 6 days is any indication, you know, I don't think this thing is going away, and they're going to have to deal with it sooner or later, whether they like it or not.
That was Chris Perfett speaking with Save the Crew representative Morgan Hughes for Match Volume. That's it for From Where We Are Today. Today's show was produced by Norhan Matmut. We had help today from Jody Sullivan. Chris Perfett is our board operator. The theme music was composed by Derek Renfro. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Annenberg Media. I'm Nadia Caldwell.